Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This mic down here in Arizona land, your mind is your primary weapon. Today is the 1st of October, 2018, and it's a Monday. You're tuned into Liberty Tree Radio. Get back to our lessons on the War of the Fleet. It covered a little bit about Sun Tzu, Kalamazoo before. have a little review. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today, and thank you for helping keep Liberty Tree Radio on the air. And thank you for telling your friends about Liberty Tree Radio. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com. At first two words phonetically, Alpha Lima Tango Hotel Alpha Bravo Echo Bravo 762@hotmail.com. And as always, I send this broadcast out to Lily, Grace, Antoinette. Last couple of weeks, we've been interviewing Ted Midward, tedmidward.info, on the broadcast. It's quite interesting that, time flies when you're having fun. We covered a lot of different subjects in the last couple of weeks, and as usual, time runs out before we've got everything covered. Ted said he'd like to come back on. I don't want to burn him out, bringing him on week after week, unless that's what he wants. But that's not up to me to decide. Obviously, the invitation is there. Has a lot of insightful information. And it's important because his pond, my pond, we're not going to get this done by ourselves. Many hands make for light work. A part of it is the enemy likes to divide and subdivide us, splinter these groups, causing dissension, friction, infighting, and people go off and make another smaller group. And one of the things that we had covered in the last couple of weeks was that oftentimes we find that, yes, maybe there are hundreds or thousands of issues, but we could boil them all down to, let's just say, 10 things. And instead of, and there might be discrepancies or disagreements in one of those items, whether it's the item itself or how to address that item. And instead of working together on the 9 things that we agree on, it usually deteriorates into squabbling over the one issue that we disagree on. And it's just unfortunate. Sun Tzu and the Art of War, some of the principles of guerrilla strategy and tactics. Terrain as a determining factor. Guerrilla war in urban areas. And the character of the guerrilla. All warfare is based on deception. Therefore, when capable, feign incapacity. When active, inactivity. When near, make it appear that you're far away. When far away, that you're near. Offer the enemy a bait to lure him. Feign disorder and strike. When he concentrates, prepare against him. Where he is strong, avoid him. Anger is general and confuse him. Pretend inferiority and encourage his arrogance. Keep him under a strain and wear him down. When he is united, divide him. Attack where he is unprepared. Sally out when he does not expect you. And these are the strategist keys to victory. And it reminds me as we go through these of obvious lesson of Desert Storm. Remember Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait on the 2nd of August, 1990, concentrated his forces in Kuwait City. And while a lot of the troops were being quietly shifted to the west, that General Schwarzkopf invited the media, planned, had the Navy in the Persian Gulf, and had the Marines Semper Fi, having an amphibious landing. And there was talk of about, well, that's the only way to take Kuwait City is we have to go in here on the beaches. And now I'm not sure exactly the number. It seemed to me it was around Saddam Hussein had 500,000 troops, quite a few of them concentrated in Kuwait, and then strung out to the west along the border. But right after this great big press deal and the televised worldwide about the amphibious landing, Saddam Hussein increased his troops in Kuwait, especially Kuwait City, by another 50%. So those troops had to come from somewhere, whether they were on the interior of Iraq or along the northern border or even on the border with Saudi Arabia, strung out to the west. And this is another classic Sun Tzu. Couldn't fit it any more perfectly about making a noise in the east and striking in the west. While they were feigning an amphibious assault by the Marines out of the Persian Gulf into Kuwait and Kuwait City, quietly, they were, the United States and the coalition forces were massing a massive amount of troops all the way out towards Rafah. Some troops were actually further on out than that. But that's another story for another day. Make a noise in the east and strike in the west. And while they pinned Saddam's troops down in Kuwait City after the 40 days and 40 nights of intense aerial bombing, even if Saddam had discovered that the amphibious landing was a feint, there would have been no way that he could have shifted his troops out to the west to counterattack General Schwarzkopf's Hail Mary play. I'm not sure if that's a proper terminology, but that's what General Schwarzkopf, may God bless his soul, actually, because usually a Hail Mary play is kind of a desperate, you're down, clock's running out, and we got to make up some ground. So we're going to send everybody go deep, and whoever's in the clear, the quarterback's going to throw the long bomb and hopefully can catch it, break the tackles, and go in for the score. He shoots, he scores. But the General Schwarzkopf's Hail Mary play certainly was not a desperate move. It was deception. Because our quotation from Sun Tzu in his essay, The Art of War, and it's the oldest known writing on the subject, predating the Christian era by several centuries. Now, there's also another general, I don't recall his name right off, that even predated Sun Tzu, that it was called the 36 Stratagems of War. Now, when we talk about books, clearly, as I understand, these were strips of bamboo that the writing was on, and they were strung together with string and rolled up like a scroll. But at that time, that was what they termed, or what we would view as a book, not like a modern book. So there may be some discrepancy, and there certainly is a possibility, especially when you find the 36 stratagems of warfare, that a lot of them are very similar to Sun Tzu's The Art of War. Now, the striking resemblance to the military axioms of Mao Zedong is no coincidence. Mao has studied Sun Tzu thoroughly, Sun Tzu, Sun Tzu, and acknowledges his debt. Many of the Chinese generals' dicta are, in fact, mere paraphrases of those of the art of war. Because we quote the general to make a point, and it is that modern warfare is, in the most common usage, a cant phrase indicative of the confusion of journalists and politicians who mistake technology for science. For despite the impressive technological innovations of the 20th century, the principles of warfare are not modern, but ancient. So it's just the technology. We don't have sailing vessels and we're going to rely on the wind to fill our sails. So we have modern landing craft and we're going to have TV, satellite, invite the media in to televise these mock landings on the Kuwaiti coast. Worked like a charm. Worked like a charm. Now, aircraft and artillery, well, they provide weapons of far greater range than the longbow. Explosives formidably multiply the striking power of an arrow. Tanks are better than shields, and trucks and helicopters offer swifter and more dependable transportation than mules and camels. The problem of generalship remains the same. The variable factors of terrain, weather, space, time, population, and above all, morale and strategy still determine the outcome of battles and campaigns. Now, if there's anything new about guerrilla war, of what Sun Tzu surprisingly anticipates by 2,000 years, virtually all questions of a military nature, and it's only in its modern political application. Or, to put it another way, the specifically modern aspect of guerrilla warfare is in its use as a tool of political revolution. The single sure method by which an unarmed population can overcome mechanized armies or, failing to overcome them, can stalemate them and make them irrelevant. And to understand how this comes about does not require a study of military tactics so much as of the political problems to which the military methods, guerrilla methods, may provide a solution. The guerrilla is a political insurgent, the conscious agent of revolution. His military role, while vital, is only incidental to his political mission. His insurgency is dedicated to a single purpose, the overthrow of the government and the destruction of the existing political or social will. It may be economic system. Now, in the process of accomplishing the goal, he may have to defeat and will certainly have to engage and outmaneuver organized professional military forces. And if so, his maneuvers, except where immediate survival is at stake, will be undertaken primarily for their political effect. Each battle will be a lesson designed to demonstrate the impotence of the army and so to discredit the government that employs it. Each campaign will be a text intended to raise the level of revolutionary awareness and anticipation of the popular majorities whose attitudes will determine the outcome of the struggle. Guerrilla actions will have certain obvious military objectives: to obtain weapons, ammunition, and supplies, to inflict casualties, to force the enemy to overextend his line so that his communications may be disrupted and small units picked off one at a time by locally superior rebel forces. But psychological and political objectives will be paramount. local military success will serve no purpose if the guerrilla campaign does not also weaken the morale of the government and its soldiers, strain the financial resources of the regime, and increase the political pressure on it by creating widespread apprehension and dissatisfaction with the progress of the war, in which there is no progress and no end in sight. Now, obviously, none of this can occur except in the presence of certain distinct social and political conditions, which combine to produce a potentially revolutionary situation. Successful insurgencies presuppose the existence of valid popular grievances, sharp social divisions, an unsound or stagnant economy, an oppressive government. And these factors obtaining revolution will still be far off unless there exists or comes into existence the nucleus of a revolutionary organization capable of articulating and exploiting popular dissatisfaction with the status quo. Now, ordinarily, revolutionary situations produce their own revolutionary leadership, coming from the most unstable social sectors. And it can be expected to include the most radical, most frustrated and ambitious elements of the political out parties, the more idealistic and least successful members of the middle class, and those most outraged by the unaccustomed pinch of oppression. The long tyrannized peasant, for example, is seldom as revolutionary as the relatively fortunate student or worker who has been led to believe that he has rights and finds, in a change of political climate, that he's deprived of them. Now, in the potentially revolutionary situation, spontaneous insurgencies may be expected. They're likely to rise out of almost any sort of social conflict, a strike, an election campaign, a dispute over land or wages or prices or rents or schools, or any one of a score of other social problems, bickering over a Supreme Court nominee. Often, they'll come into reaction to some act of repression or of a real or fancied injustice on the part of the governing authorities. For an example, when the efforts of the police to curb a popular demonstration turn the demonstration into a riot. Oftentimes, that's what the agitprop wants to happen. Now, the means are not important. The important element is the leadership itself. Bandits are not revolutionaries. Looters are not guerrillas. And in order to attain a following, the revolutionary leaders must stand on firm moral ground. They must have some greater purpose than the furtherance of personal ambition. And this, in turn, implies an ideology or a clear cause to explain their decisions and the reason of their insurgency. They cannot be mere opportunists. Now, when conflict occurs, whether spontaneous or induced, the revolutionary leaders must be capable of explaining and rationalizing its confused and often apparently accidental character. Isolated acts of defiance must be given coherence within the revolutionary frame of reference. The leadership must be prepared to make the most of every opportunity to accelerate the process of social ferment and political disruption. So the first task of the revolutionary cadre must be to relate each incident and each phase of the conflict to a great cause so that the revolutionary violence is seen as the natural and moral means to a desired end, and the masses of the people are increasingly involved. The struggle cannot be allowed to seem meaningless or chaotic It must be given a progressive character in all its phases. It must arouse great expectations and appear crucial at every stage so that no one can stand outside of it. Now, the precise cause itself is not of great consequence. One is often as good as another. In Cuba, for example, the corruption of the Batista regime and the illegitimacy were seemingly sufficient causes for the well-to-do middle class so long as its members individually did not take any great personal risk, but merely sympathized with and abetted the active revolutionaries. When the sons of the middle class were imprisoned or killed or tortured for their activities, oppression became the most urgent cause. Economic nationalism was the real cause of the rich and ambitious industrialists and entrepreneurs who opposed Batista. Political ambition, which could not be avowed, and a sense of social injustice, which could, were the causes that drove the frustrated youth and the poor white-collar classes to become the cadre and the greatest zealots of the revolution. And now, on the other hand, the landless campesinos, the economically deprived macheteros of the sugar cane plantations, the squatters of the Sierra Maestra, were driven by actual hunger, by real oppression, and by a longing for the security of land of their own under a just social system. Motivations that transcended any question of moral or political causes. The nominal causes varied according to the local situation. The constant, consistent appeal of the revolutionary leadership was broader, being based on the democratic, egalitarian ideology linked to notions of social justice. Long accepted in Cuba, there was nothing new about Castro's brand of humanism. It was written into the Cuban Constitution. And a clear political goal, the overthrow of Batista regime and the complete destruction or of severance from everything that supported it. The overthrow of Batista was presented as a panacea, the remedy of all existing evils. As a cause, it related and made understandable each isolated political development. The assassination of a policeman, the martyrdom of a terrorist, the suspension of civil liberties, or a public demonstration demanding their restoration, any disruption of the ordinary routine, anything that helped to undermine the regime was held up as a skirmish or a battle in a great crusade. This state of mind prevailing, the process of cutting away Batista's support and increasing the pressure against him, both inside and outside of the country, continued according to a pattern that we already have looked at in detail. Now, the Cuban example provides, as well as any other, the recipe for successful insurgency. The prerequisites are, one, an unstable political situation marked by sharp social divisions and usually, but not always, by a foundering or stagnant economy. Kind of like what exists here in the United States. Number two, a political objective based on firm moral and ideological grounds that can be understood and accepted by the majority as the overriding cause of the insurgency. Desirable in itself and worthy of any sacrifice. Number three, an oppressive government with which no political compromise is possible. And four, some form of revolutionary political organization capable of providing dedicated and consistent leadership towards the accepted goal. Now you understand why one of the reasons why I brought Ted Midward up. Some form of revolutionary political organization capable of providing dedicated and consistent leadership towards the accepted goal. Now, there's one final requirement, the clear possibility or even the probability of success. Until people believe that a government can be overthrown, and it must be the first act of the insurgency to demonstrate this possibility by successful defiance of military force. The attempt will not be made. The revolutionary following will not be found. Now, the specific techniques or tactics of guerrilla warfare are not, except in unimportant detail, to be learned from text. They relate always to the specific local situation and are supremely expedient. The guerrilla is, above all, an improviser. The nature of his improvisation depends, naturally, on immediate and long-range objectives. The terrain, the relative strength of his forces, and those of the enemy, the material means at his disposal, and similar factors. And since the guerrilla's numerical strength and arms are inferior to those of the enemy, or he would not be the guerrilla, and since his most immediate concern is mere survival, the basis of all guerrilla tactics is, obviously, evasion. Successful evasion means the ability to avoid confrontation, except at one's own choosing, yet always to be able to achieve the local superiority to strike with effect. I see we're down at the bottom of the hour. We'll take a little pause for the cause right now. And so that's the whole point. We have to join together with the band. We'll be right back. Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Your mind is your primary weapon. 1 October 2018, it's a Monday, and you're tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today. Please tell your friends about the broadcast and all the lineup here on Liberty Tree Radio. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com. Send this one out to Lily Grace Antoinette. In the first 30 minutes of today's broadcast, we covered some of these concepts, Sun Tzu, Sun Tzu, and also made a direct analogy with the saint of a amphibious assault out of the Persian Gulf into Kuwait City by General Thurman Norman Schwarzkopf, on how he made the noise in the east and attacked in the west. Classic example, getting the enemy to concentrate in one area while you have no intentions of attacking there. But it was to concentrate his forces so you could attack where he wasn't so strong. I know you've heard me talk about Bob Miner about 50 million times here since January, but if you would like to give Bob a telephone call, maybe some words of encouragement, please be polite. The telephone is 701-251-2365. A message will come on, ask if you want to speak to him directly, purchase a phone card, and then it'll ask you to enter in the first three letters of his last name, M-I-N, translates out to 646. And then it'll say, leave a message after the tone and say, hey, Bob, this is Mike down here in Arizona land. Just hang in there. We're with you. If you'd like to send Bob a letter, and we've covered the reasoning behind the letter aspect, it's Bob Miner, or Robert Miner, if you would prefer. SCCC, four letters, and that would translate phonetically to Sierra, Charlie, 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 205 6th Street Southeast, Suite 201, Jamestown, North Dakota, 58401. We bring up these lessons because, to quote Sun Tzu, if I am able to determine the enemy's disposition, while at the same time I can feel my own, then I can concentrate and he must divide. And if I concentrate while he divides, I can use my entire strength to attack a fraction of his. An enemy must not know where I intend to give battle. For if he does not know where I intend to give battle, he must prepare in a great many places. And when he prepares in a great many places, those I have to fight in any one place will be few. And when he prepares everywhere, he will be weak everywhere. Now, This explains, as well as anything that's ever been written, how it is possible for a relative handful of armed men to oppose a vastly superior military. And the secrets of success are, first, superior intelligence, and second, terrain. Guerrillas, representing a popular cause, have the tremendous advantage of an intelligence service that can encompass virtually the entire population. The population hides them, and at the same time, it reveals from day to day and hour to hour the disposition and the strength of the enemy. First, always know where the soldiers are. Fidel Castro said in an interview in the Sierra Maestra early in 1957, but to continue, quote, "But they never know where we are. We can come and go as we like, moving through our lines, but they can never find us unless we wish them to, and then it is only on our terms," end quote. Now, at the time, Castro had perhaps 100 guerrillas at his disposal. Now, in theory, he was surrounded by some 5,000 Batista soldiers, but in the wild and trackless terrain of the Sierra Maestra, roaming over some 5,000 square miles of mountains and dense forest, amongst the rural population surely sympathetic to him and hostile to Batista, his being surrounded was an irrelevance. The ocean is surrounded, but the fish do not care. Now, when a choice of ground is possible, the terrain for guerrilla operations should be carefully selected. The ideal will be found in a country that is more rural than urban, mountainous rather than flat, thickly forested rather than bare, with extensive rail lines, bad roads, and an economy that is preponderantly agricultural rather than industrial. The relative dispersion or concentration of the population is also of great importance. A region with a widely scattered rural population living in small hamlets and isolated farm dwellings is much more vulnerable than one of tightly knit large country towns separated by wide areas of open farmland. The terrain should afford both natural concealment and obstacles to hinder the movement of military transport. Mountains and swamps where tanks and trucks cannot go, woods and thick brush that provide cover from aerial observation and attack, force from which to strike quickly and safely at enemy rail and highway communications, and in which to ambush small military units. And there should be sufficient space to maneuver freely without the danger of being caught in a closing spiral of encirclement. The greater the area of operations, the more difficult it'll be for the army to locate the guerrillas, and the more the government will have to disperse its troops and extend its lines of supply and communications. Yet the guerrillas cannot choose the remotest and most rugged areas in which they would be safest. They must remain constantly in contact with the rural population from which they recruit to draw supplies and to obtain reliable couriers who will carry messages and directions to and from the revolutionary underground in the towns and the cities. Now, this necessity indicates the choice of an area with a dispersed rather than concentrated rural population. And that type of an area will usually afford the natural concealment and natural obstacles to army operations found in desolate areas. And it's going to provide a further advantage. It will not be economic for the government to garrison. Now, large rural towns can be garrisoned. Timely hamlets cannot. Where there are many of them, only a few soldiers can be assigned to each. And to concentrate such rural outpost is worse than useless, since each individual post can be easily be overwhelmed, its soldiers captured or killed, their arms and ammunition seized, and another propaganda victory thus scored by the insurgents. And since there will be no great government stake in any given hamlet, farm, or village in the economic or strategic terms, the natural decision of the army will be to withdraw to safer ground. Yet each such withdrawal will widen the guerrilla control and feed the insurgency, providing it with more supplies, more recruits, more room in which to maneuver. And there's another consideration. The possession of populated areas will usually provide almost as much safety for the insurgents as would the remote areas in which they cannot be located or attacked. Political considerations, if not those of humanity, will usually offer some safeguard against bombing or artillery attacks, since the government cannot afford to kill civilians indiscriminately. And the danger of being isolated far from the populated areas has been demonstrated by the experience of guerrillas in Malaya and the Philippines. In both instances, the military succeeded in isolating the insurgents, cutting them off from the source of their strength with recruits, and the results fatal to the insurgency. Now, on the other hand, the possibility of fighting a successful guerrilla war on a small island with little room to maneuver and no real wilderness sanctuary has been proven by Cypriot fighters of EOKA. When pressed, the small guerrilla bands commanded by Grievous in the hills of Cyprus would filter back into the towns. The known fugitives who could not do so lived like foxes in earthen dugouts, so well camouflaged that British soldiers often walked above their heads without discovering them. Others sallied forth on night forays from hiding places under the floors of homes from where they had lain all day, their presence unsuspected. They were, in the most literal sense, underground. Now, even in well-policed large cities, a sympathetic population can protect active insurgents. The draconian message used by the French in Algeria virtually stamped out the FLA underground there, but only because the Muslims of the Kasbah had already separated racially and physically from the French population rocking the Kasbah. While soldiers, especially foreigners, can suppress urban rebellion, as in Budapest, by treating the entire metropolis as a city under wartime siege, controlling all movement, and ruthlessly killing the inhabitants of any quarter where resistance is offered. And gradually, an urban population can be starved or terrorized into submission. But those methods scarcely apply to the civil war situation in which there is no sure way of knowing friend from foe. Terrain and local conditions ultimately decide the size and organization of the guerrilla band. Now in Cuba, Sierra Maestra, columns of 100 to 120 men proved best, as such a force being competent to deal with any military group that might penetrate its base area, and the greater numbers were unwieldy on the march and difficult to supply, given the resources of a very thinly populated region with a marginal agricultural economy. Now, in more densely populated, more prosperous rural areas, a platoon of 30 to 40 men would occupy a hamlet or small village and its environs. Guard posts were established along the margins of the entire Territorio Libre, and the zone was administered as a state within a state, kind of like what's going on down in Mexico right now. Now, in the suburban areas, on the other hand, concealment was the determining factor, and the guerrillas who worked close to the larger towns, interdicting the highways and cutting communications and the power lines, operated in squads of 3 to 8 men, striking from ambush and then quickly hiding in the brush or at times in the homes of residents. Raids on suburban military posts and outlying industrial establishments were often made by commandos living within the town, who would assemble for a night action and then quickly disperse to their homes to resume their normal daytime occupations. Now, with respect to the conditions that prevail in most Latin American republics, Che Guevara considers that a nucleus of 30 to 50 armed men is sufficient to initiate a guerrilla insurgency with good assurance of success. If the nucleus, organized and armed in strictest secrecy, exceeds 150, it should be divided and the action begun in two regions well apart. When an active guerrilla column grows beyond 100 or so, it should again be divided and action begun on a new front. Now, there is a positive as well as a negative reason for this spread rebellion amongst the people. Now, the guerrillas are missionaries. Their task is not merely to oppose the army, but to spread rebellion amongst the people. And the wider their area of contact with the population, the better for their cause. The guerrilla nucleus initiates the conflict, if possible, on the edge of a wilderness sanctuary, in a thinly populated agricultural area with a marginal economy within easy striking distance of the strategic targets, railway lines that can be cut, communications that can be disrupted, mining or industrial plants that can be sabotaged, small military or police posts from which arms can be seized, and at the same time, the urban insurrection of a hit-and-run rather than a sustained character is created by the revolutionary underground, so as to give the insurgency a general national complexion for maximum propaganda effect. It is not enough to rebel. The rebellion must be the object of national attention, too shocking in its initial effects to be ignored by even a controlled press or quickly explained away, as been the case with many abortive provincial insurrections, by a government safe in an untroubled capital far from the scene of battle. Now, when the first excitement is died away and order has been restored in the towns where the uprisings have occurred, the guerrillas can expect the army to bring the battle to them. They will not have to seek it. The government will order a bandit suppression campaign. Troops will be dispatched by motor convoy or airlift to the region of reported guerrilla activity. Spotter planes will skim the treetops, seeking the insurgents. Soldiers will occupy the villages and patrol the roads. Foot columns will penetrate deeply into the rebel territory, trying to make contact. Helicopters may be used to ferry troops to the strategic encampments deep in the forest or mountains from which patrols can fan out in search of the rebels. If the military commander knows what he is about, he may adopt some variation of the French oil slick techniques, grinding the region on his map and attempting to clear it a square at a time, driving the guerrillas slowly towards a prepared killing zone or zones where their only apparent route of escape will bring them into the open, much as tigers are driven by beaters into the guns of the hunters. The oil slick method is theoretically sound, but in practice, it's far from foolproof. Since its rare that a government can admit serious concerns over the activities of a small band of guerrillas. The chances are that the military force sent on the suppression campaign will be far from adequate for the task, in which a ratio of 10 to 1 is prescribed, and 500 soldiers to each guerrilla would not be at all excessive. Regardless of the number of troops involved, the guerrillas will fight according to certain principles. They will not seek to hold ground or to contend with the stronger force, but only to confuse and exhaust it and to inflict casualties on it without taking casualties in return. The key to this kind of action is the well-placed ambush. Generally, writes Sun Tzu, quote, "He who occupies the field of battle first and awaits his enemy at his ease, he who comes later to the fight and rushes into battle is weary." The guerrillas will not give battle until the terrain favors them. Their effort will be to lure the enemy into situations in which numbers are of little account, because the way is too steep and the passage too narrow for more than a few to proceed at a time. Think about the British back in the 1800s trying to withdraw from Afghanistan. Now, when the fighting begins, it will be on the ground of the rebels' own choosing, preferably far from the commanding heights, with dense cover and limited visibility, where a few determined men can hold up an army. Ambushes will be prepared in such a manner that a small portion of the advancing military column, its vanguard, will be separated from the rest when the firing commences. The fire of the main body of the guerrillas will be concentrated on the vanguard, and the objective of the ambush must be the complete destruction of the advance group and seizure of its arms and ammunition, the latter task being accomplished while a small guerrilla rear guard delays the rest of the military column. Now, in this connection, Che Guevara writes, "When the force of the guerrilla band is small and it is desired above all to detain and slow down the advance of an invading column, groups of snipers from 2 to 10 in number should be distributed all around the column, at which the area at each of the 4 cardinal points. Now, in that situation, the combat can be started. Now, for example, on the right flank, when the enemy centers his action on that flank and fires on it, shooting will begin at that moment on the left flank. Now, at another moment, from the rear guard or from the vanguard, and so forth. With a very small expenditure of ammunition, it's possible to hold the enemy in check indefinitely. While the column is delayed, the main body of the guerrilla force quickly gathers its military booty and moves on towards the next prepared position, or circles around and steps out in a new direction. The snipers withdraw and rejoin the main force before the troops have recovered sufficiently to launch a counterattack. All of this occurring within a matter of minutes. The process is repeated again and again. When it's been determined that a military column is sufficiently isolated that the arrival of reinforcements can be delayed for some hours or days, the guerrillas may even attempt an encirclement, or may create the appearance of an encirclement by stationing squads of snipers on commanding ground and in such a way as to bring the troops under fire in whichever direction they attempt to move. If the troops launch a determined assault, the guerrillas have only to give way, circle around, regroup, and again withdraw. of the superior mobility and small size of the guerrilla force are its main asset. The danger that they themselves may be encircled is usually more apparent than real. Night, as Guevara has noted, is the best ally of the guerrilla fighter. Although the Cubans use the phrase encirclement face to determine the look of someone who was frightened, Castro's guerrillas never suffered a single casualty through encirclement, and Guevara considers it no real problem for a guerrilla force. His prescription, take adequate measures to impede the advance of the enemy until nightfall and then to exfiltrate, a relatively simple matter for a small group of men in country well known to them where the cover is good. Well, it looks like we're coming up on the top of the hour, and so thusly, the close of today's broadcast. Now, bear in mind, we're over on the micro effect on Thursday and Friday. We start off at the same time, but on each day we go for 2 hours. Now that's a little bit more advanced because some of these basic concepts that we've covered over on our broadcast on the micro effect, but I do know a number of the listeners from over on that side that listen to these broadcasts here on Liberty Tree Radio. It's always good to sometimes review. It helps reinforce the lessons. Sometimes you hear some of these things, and they don't always gel, solidify. But all of a sudden, it's like in any type of lesson, all of a sudden you wake up one day, and boom, the light goes on, and you go, wow, I see what you mean. The strategy, the tactics, the training, the leadership, the planning, the intelligence preparation of the battlefield, the financing, the field sanitation, the organization, the security, the communications, the medical, the after-action review, the psychological warfare operations. Your mind is your primary weapon. Send Bob a letter. He could use some blank pages on the back of a news item to help take notes. Paper cost him a tremendous amount of money. Many hands make for light work, and you need to join together with the band. And for Lily, Grace, Antoinette, I want to thank you for being here today. I'll see you Thursday. You guys take good care of yourself. God bless. Once you're sick, keep your powder dry.
The woman on my lap and she's drinking champagne. Have white skin, got a fat and light.